Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. Today is a special episode. What I've done is I've gathered together some clips of audio that I've made while I was in Cannes this year, watching loads of amazing movies and talking to lots of amazing people. So I've gathered some of their recommendations and just some general chat basically about film. And then later on in the episode, we also will have a couple of listeners, Ian Killick and Kai Ross, who give their recommended books. So it's an opportunity for me to do a slightly different type of episode where we gather together a lot of voices and anyway, I've got a feeling you'll enjoy it. It's a slightly different episode. If you enjoy it, please remember to subscribe, to like, all that sort of stuff. But before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation.
I am Luke Hicks. I'm writing for the film stage.
Never heard of it.
Me neither.
Okay. What's your favorite?
It got me in.
How's your Cannes?
It's terrific. I haven't seen maybe one or two bad things. Everything else has been at least pretty good.
Right. Okay. Yeah. What's your favorite so far?
Oh, man. Maybe Armageddon Time or EO.
Okay. Yeah. Donkeys.
Donkeys. Yeah.
Donkeys or...
All the donkeys.
Armageddon Time's got a really weird title, right?
Yeah, it does. Also a weird title card. Yeah. Like that street graffiti in the corner. That fades in and out.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, don't worry. I'll cut out the coughing.
Okay.
What's your favorite film book?
I'm going to say Making Movies by Sidney Lumet.
Oh, it's a wonderful book, that.
Yeah, it is so fucking good. He has such a clear way of writing. It's insane. Really,
I love the way you used a Lumet style curse word as you appreciated it.
Yeah, I did. You know, it's an expletive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the book and why you like it.
I think he is just someone who has such an insane amount of experience, and the way he talks about filmmaking is a very humanist kind of way. And I feel like he brings with it this philosophy of sort of ethical spectatorship and filmmaking at the same time. So in a weird way, while he's talking about making movies, he's also teaching you how to watch movies in a sense. So I feel like it's just this holistic thing with movies where you're from really small or just intimate kind of scenes between characters that's just pure dialogue, and him talking about the way he frames those things and the way he like the level of the camera and the lighting and how all these things play into these decisions on set, and how certain films call for different things, and how there are no rules to cinema and the way you make cinema or art, but that there are there's only, you can follow the project essentially and follow it passionately with people who also care about it. He speaks so clearly. That's the thing that makes the book incredible, is all these people with incredible experience who couldn't write this book, but it's he can just tell you in such succinct and plain ways without talking over your head at all. It makes you feel like you belong in the conversation. And
Amazing. That's a great choice, Luke. I totally agree with that. He's as interested in the catering as he is in the criticism, and it's just those two branches are really, really important. Cheers, Luke. Have a great can.
All right, I will. Yeah, you too.
Oh, see?
That's great.
That'll go in.
Quite well.
Yeah, I think that sounded great to me.
What do you think? My name is Sabina Petkova, and I'm here as a critic, accredited with the press, but I'm also doing a programming gig as well.
Excellent. Well, who are you programming for?
It's my first year at Cambridge Film Festival, a part of a programming panel for the autumn feature slate. So we're getting to snag all the good titles.
Excellent. That sounds very exciting. And who are you writing for?
I'm here with Awards Watch, US-based and UK-based. I'm here with Screen Queens.
Oh, brilliant. That sounds like you've got a full platter of work to do. And we've just come out of the Coen... I keep saying Coen Brothers documentary, but of course it's Ethan Coen's documentary, Jerry Lee Lewis, Trouble in Mind. What did you think of that? Hot take.
Hot take. Great music. That's the hottest take of all hot takes, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, it buried a little bit the lead of the stories. People, like, he marries his 12-year-old cousin and that sort of gets a little left off, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, we will learn at some point that there was a gunshot involved as well in that story.
And again, that just gets passed off as a joke. Oh, he shot someone, yeah, and that's kind of funny.
But he kind of didn't mean it, you know, but he may have did it, may have not. He didn't mean to shoot him. It's just this very, very intriguing way of portraying it, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so what's your favorite film book or your film book recommendation?
I think I'd be very happy to say this. It's a book by Giuliana Bruno, who is a scholar, but the book is not itself entirely scholarly. I think it's very rich in style and examples, and it's called Atlas of Emotion.
Mm.
Yeah, do you know it?
No, I don't know. I'm writing it down right now.
Yeah. It's a really big book, I think, and it was very difficult to find. Thankfully, Verso Books republished it very recently. It's quite hefty.
Mm.
And it deals with geography and psychogeography, film space and film emotions as well. So I have never read a better analysis of Hiroshima Mon Amour, to be fair.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
And it brings out a lot of examples who are from art, other kinds of art as well.
Oh, so it's like a very culturally broad putting film inside
a
bigger...
It's a very rich text, very rich book in its textures for sure and its materials, but everything comes together in film. So she does a deep dive into how cities are portrayed, but not as main characters, but as just evocations of people's journeys as well. And I like that she puts things side by side all the time and layers everything. You know how, I think it was Sigmund Freud who wrote that memory is like a city, our subconscious is like a city, structure is like a city. So that always reminds me of this and has helped me a lot watching films and writing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how influential it's been in your own work.
Yeah, it's just inhabiting your mind, inhabiting the film with your mind in a completely different way. I mean, when I just start imagining walking through the film world and conversing with the characters, I feel like this is something that his book has done for me, for sure.
Oh, that sounds brilliant. That's definitely on my list now. Thanks
good.
For that. Thanks
good.
For that.
I'm very happy. I'm always happy to sing praises to this book because, Giuliana hasn't had a lot of love given outside of academia, so I'm happy to do that.
Great. And what's sort of been your hit of Cannes so far?
Oh, I really, really love Triangle of Sadness.
Me too.
I stand by. This is such a good title. I.
And it continues the geometry theme. You know, it's gonna have a quadrology of the square, the triangle.
Yeah,
it needs to go for an octagon at some point.
Yeah, we are. I'm there for it for sure. And it was so funny. I don't think I've laughed that much all throughout Cannes, like put together.
A lot of people are saying like it's a quite obvious satire because it's hitting very big targets, you know, in a barrel, but
isn't that the same for every satire though? You can be saying that for every satire, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And what's wrong with being obvious?
No, and I think the best satires are things that, you know, we take seriously, but then we are also able to joke about it. You know that, of course.
Of course I do. Of course, a satirist myself at times. Thank you so much, Sabina, for giving us your recommended book.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
Dreamy one is Jeffrey O'Brien's Phantom Empire.
Okay.
Which is basically, I don't even know. I actually I taught it to students this past fall, and I some of the students that I thought would hate it, like there are people who maybe like more into genre films or like Marvel comics or something, just absolutely adored this thing. And it's just kind of this dream vision of what movies can mean. And he talks a lot about Italian horror films that he's seen that he loved. Actually, he's kind of fixated on those.
Mario Bava and all that stuff.
But it's just a really beautiful book, and it really just kind of open-hearted and explosive. And I don't know, I guess off the top of my head, that's one. That's, yeah.
What was the other one?
The other one would probably be The Devil's Candy by Julie Solomon, which is a favorite of many people. Just going behind the scenes of Brian De Palma's film version of Bonfire of the Vanities, which was a, you know, kind of famous flop at the time. And I think this book just lays out really well all the things that can go wrong against a filmmaker's best intentions. And and actually the movie in the context of today, it's not really all that bad, but no. At the time it was the film that everybody liked to beat up on, so kind of a cautionary tale.
And Bruce Willis comes off not particularly well.
No, yes, he doesn't, but poor Bruce Willis, we're not going to beat up on him right now.
Not anymore.
No.
Can I ask as well, Stephanie, what have you seen at Cannes? How's your Cannes going, and what have been your highlights?
Oh, my highlights this year, I would say, are James Gray's Armageddon Time. I love James Gray. Anyway, I love everything that he's done, so I'm kind of a James Gray nut. But this film, I thought... It's so subtle in the way it kind of explains a lot of things that have gone wrong in our country, in America, and a lot about like race relations and things that we could have changed 40 years ago. I mean, 60 years ago, 80 years ago, we should have been like changing things from the beginning, but. We've had so much time to try to solve some of these problems, and yet we still have some of the same problems. And I think this film explores that in a really honest and intelligent way. And my other favorite is Kelly Reichardt's Showing Up, which is about Michelle Williams plays an artist, a ceramicist, who has kind of like a prickly personality. She's one of those people that you kind of like don't really want to be around a lot. And it's a wonderful performance. I think she embodies that, like, you know, really well. But of course, obviously, you also feel something for her. And it's about being an artist. I mean, I don't know who really wants to watch a movie about people being artists. Maybe it's not that interesting, but, you know, this idea that you need solitude and you need to be kind of inside your head to do something. And also the art she makes, I mean, I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler, but, you know, you see her at the beginning of the process, like making these sculptures, and you're looking at them and you think, oh my God, these things are like actually really ugly. And then by the end, you're looking at them, you see them in a different way. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love to. I'm looking forward to that. That's on Friday. I'm going to go and see that. So that's great. Okay, well, thank you very much. Could you tell us also your full name and the publication you write for as well, so that our listeners, can become your readers?
Yes. I'm Stephanie Zaharik, and I'm the film critic at Time.
Excellent. Thank you, Stephanie.
Super duper.
You didn't tell me you were going to do that.
I know, because I knew you. Hi, everyone. I'm here with Jason Solomons, who is in Cannes. Under what? What's your current umbrella?
It's a hub more than umbrella. It's got lots of spokes. So I am still covering the festival for the New European and for Radio 4 Front Row and for my own Seen Any Good Films Lately podcast. But this is my 25th Cannes as a critic and presenter, but I'm also my first Cannes as a producer, John. and I feel like a newbie and a fresh babe ready to be eaten up by the sharks.
And because this is Writers on Film, we're interested in books, and you've got a book which you're actually have optioned and are looking to make into a film, is that right?
That's right, yeah. So this isn't strictly a film book, but it will be a book that's being made into a film by me. It's called A Waiter in Paris, and it's written by Edward Chisholm, and it actually came out in the UK while we were here, so I had it sort of at an early stage, and I completely fell in love with it as a coup de foudre. It's about a young British kid who goes to Paris dreaming of being a writer, full of romantic dreams and new wave images in his head, and he just gets sucked into this world of this Grand Brasserie where he gets a job as a waiter, and we find out that sort of multifarious goings on behind those swing doors. You're there as a tourist dining, but actually back there's a whole world of waiters that are sort of dispossessed Polish aristocrats, crazed drug dealers, wannabe actors, Malaysians, Tamil refugees, Senegalese washer-uppers. It's just fabulous world, I thought, full of loads of characters, and I just was reading it and casting it in my head and seeing it, and there's lots of little tricks about how they sort of use olive oil to wipe their shoes, slick up their hair, polish those trays so they come out all shining and the stuff sort of sticks to the tray so it doesn't fall over, and he has to learn all of that, and then he falls in love with a glamorous hostess who's way too haughty for him, and then there's the sort of bossy woman who does all the sort of organizing. She's like the maitre d', come madame this place. Then there's a sort of politician and his mistress who pop in, and there's a director and his actress, and then during fashion week there's all the sort of models and fashionistas. I just thought, what a fantastic world, I want to make this into a film. So I've asked the guy who's written it, Ed Chisholm. It's his first book. It's a memoir, actually. I keep thinking of it as a fiction, but it is actually a memoir. This is what he actually did, like George Orwell when he was down and out.
Right, I was thinking of that when you were talking.
There's a sort of Emily in Paris cheesiness to it, but there's also this kind of quite gritty poverty, below the line, gig economy sort of situation.
Camembert-ness.
Yes, I would say camembert, but with a little truffle on top. Yeah. But I mean, what I love about it is that it's all in the service of this, you know, brasserie food. So if the tourists come in and they order a croque monsieur or, you know, confit de canard, and it's made and constructed, but there's not a single French hand that touches it by the time it gets to your plate. But it is a construct of this sort of French mythology and this Parisian mythology. And of course, waiters are sort of the fabric of Paris. If there's any one city in the world where you can be a career waiter, it's Paris. But it's very hard to get out of it. There are these people who've been doing it for years and years, because it's quite a drug. You know, some days you'll get like a grand in tips, and then you just go out and blow it. Mm. And you're sort of supposed to. You're not supposed to keep your tips. That's the joy of it. So I'm thrilled to be adapting. I think it can be really good. But what's really interesting this year, and you might find this when you're reading your books, is that people 5 years ago they said, "Yeah, that's a movie." Right now they're sort of saying, "Well, it sounds like a telly. Sounds like a TV."
Right, it's something on Netflix.
Exactly, which I'm not against, but it's not my natural habitat. I read it and thought it was felt like a movie. And throughout, when he goes and gets his tips, he nips off to midnight screenings and goes and sees, you know, in Paris you've got all these rep theatres. He goes and sees Melville's, and he goes and sees the little Goddard seasons. So I knew where he was in his head with all of this. But yeah, people in the industry sort of say, "Oh, it sounds like a telly." But everyone's desperate for a telly. That's why.
Yeah, I've had that a lot where I've pitched screenplays to people, and it's like, could it be a 10-episoder?
Yeah. You know. I think people want it sort of in a way, because it keeps them busy, and it's sort of like, right, that's me done for 3 years. Season three of that. But I still think there's something about movies that works. I mean, we can have a spin-off, can't we, afterwards? But I think there's something about the sort of beginning, middle and end of a great movie that's how I see it. And I think that's how the book is written. And certainly Ed Chisholm, the writer, he's going to adapt the screenplay, which is quite unusual, apparently. That doesn't always work. But when I read it, I just thought, well, this guy's a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And it jumps off the page, the dialogue and the descriptions of Paris and the cold and the strange creatures that live in the sort of in the cheap hotels or the flop houses of Paris.
You've pitched it to me. I'm on board. I'll
come see it.
Yeah. So have you managed to see any films while you've been here, between pitch meetings and shark sessions?
Yeah, I have actually. I've done all right. Not as much as I normally do, hence, you filling in quite nicely. I missed the Moon Age Daydream David Bowie doc. I did love Mia Hansen Love's Un Beau Matin, One Fine Morning. It may be because I'm particularly tuned to Paris, but I just love the way she makes the everyday feel just very special. She's got a real textured work, and I think Léa Seydoux who was here at Cannes last year in the summer with 5 films and was a bit rubbish in all of them, or the films were rubbish. I just thought she was luminous and it's just wonderful in this. And I could watch her. She's on the screen almost all the time, sometimes undressed. And this, I just thought it made sense for her to do it. It was the right. She's looking after her ailing father. She's looking after her son because she's a single mum. She starts quite an ill-advised affair with an old friend. And it's just the sort of... And she has a job to keep down as well. And it's just like, that's what I've got to do today, deal with all of that. And it all comes to a head. And you just say, oh, that's not easy, is it, life, sometimes?
That's brilliant. I haven't seen that. I've got a ticket for it tomorrow. So I'm looking forward to it on that recommendation. Could I ask, Jason, have you got a film book that you could recommend? It could be something you've read recently or it can be an old favourite. It's totally up to you.
I would... What's my favourite film? That's a good question. I haven't been a guest on Writers on Film yet, obviously. I'll tell you what I think is the most extraordinary film book, slightly for me, is Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing, which is his own memoir. And I would recommend it as an audio book because he does the reading.
Right, right.
Which is amazing. And it's fine. It's all sort of like, oh, well, I was working with Sid Caesar, and then I met Keaton, and we made all this. And then I met Mia Farrow. Let me tell you about Mia Farrow, and he just goes off on, like, it's quite vicious. I mean, it's not pleasant at all. It completely changes the tone of the book and addresses the current place where we are now with Woody being cancelled. And it's a sort of stern defence of himself in this memoir. And then it sort of finishes and goes back to, like, and then I met Sun Yee and it's all fine, and then I made, you know, nice things with Diane Wiest. It sort of carries on, but the middle of it is explosive. And to hear him, because I read it first, and then to hear him say it, I mean, it's just extraordinary. It's like he's gone off on one for about 35 pages.
Do you think it reads as a convincing defence? Because I've heard people say actually he sort of condemns himself out of his own mouth in his vitriol that you saw.
Yeah, you it's so hornet's nest that has been stirred, and it doesn't. What is funny is that it's not funny at all. It doesn't suit him. This register, this tone. He's not the avuncular Woody that you've seen on screen or that I've interviewed several times. It's something shifts in him. Mm. A steeliness comes in, and almost kind of cold-heartedness in there. And it's a really weird because he's so known for his warmth, his comic warmth and his comic sort of look on humanity. Suddenly there comes this sort of steely, right, I'm going to... almost killer in there. And that's... And of course Woody Allen isn't... He isn't a schlemiel, he isn't a useless nibbish, otherwise he wouldn't be able to make 50 films. You know, this guy can get his films and get some of the world's biggest stars in his movies, so there must be something, a killer instinct about him. And he turns it over and he gets it done on time and on budget. It's that bit that comes out, the cold professional, almost, there's something of the assassin in that. Because he's such a great writer, there's not nary a word... over, you know, it's very short, like his films, they're sort of coming in at a nice 95 minutes, you know. And that in this, it's like bang, 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 every little point is made, and they're like little pins being into it. It's an extraordinary book, really.
That's fascinating. And of course, you've written your own book about Woody Allen. Have you any plans to go back and write about something else, or do you feel kind of done with your book, exhausted? Because of course, the timing was not great.
The first book was all right, but it was okay. The second edition that wasn't great. That was just like, I mean, I was almost going to pulp it, you know, but we published it. It was ready to go in the warehouse, but it hasn't, just people weren't buying it. Although I'm getting a lot of people seem to be forgetting the Woody Allen thing, and they're picking it up now. People are remembering Woody Allen and suddenly getting some sales and people commenting, going, oh, I've just bought your book on Woody Allen. Just because I kept thinking it's going to be out of date, you know, that's why I kept doing a second edition. But as it happens, quite handily, he hasn't actually made another film for a while. So it's not particularly out of date. I think there's only Rainy Day in New York that's not in there. So I've got a bit... So there is another addendum to the Woody Allen book that addresses this late interest in him, because that's not in the book, and that's why I thought it's not even proper, I need to talk about this in the book, what this current reassessment, and that documentary that what's his name, Bob, the guy did Sick, but they made, and that was the one that really sort of put the cat among the pigeons, and they used the audio book actually, because Woody obviously wouldn't give them an interview, so they went, right, well, we're going to take some of the audio from the audio book of Apropos of Nothing and use that. I don't think is right, but it certainly sounds like they've interviewed him.
Right, without actually necessarily saying, this is from the audiobook.
Yeah, exactly. It's really cheap, I think.
Yeah.
But it's just a cheap shot, but it hits.
Right.
So, yes, I was writing a book during the pandemic about how the pandemic has changed movies.
Mm.
And it was quite interesting while I was doing it. And there's some nice writing in it, but when the pandemic was lifting, I came to reread it back. I thought, I don't want to read anything about the pandemic.
I was talking to a director today who says, "Oh, my new documentary is coming out." I was like, "What is it about?" "It's about the pandemic in Georgia." And it's like,
it feels irrelevant. It may not do. I thought it needs documenting, but it was about the delay of Bond, and it just all felt like, well, we survived and it's all right. But I think I will revisit it. And retool it. It's sort of a memoir in movies because I was sort of stopping being more of a critic and trying to move to production. And I thought, well, I should sort of remember my 25 years as a critic. But it needed more structure. It needs more structure. But there will be one coming.
Oh, brilliant. And then you'll come on. I mean, you can come on and talk about Woody whenever you like, but I'm not pushed because I thought maybe it's a sore subject, maybe.
No, we were going to do it, weren't we, last summer, and then I started writing this other one, and that got in the way. So, no, I'm still... It's sort of an ongoing saga, the Woody thing. That's right. No, I'd be fascinated to talk to you in more depth about Woody Allen film by film.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd love to have you on. Thanks so much, Jason.
Salut, Jean.
Now we're going to move on to the section where a couple of listeners volunteered to give me their recommended books. I'm extremely lucky that among my listenership as such, I have lots of people who themselves are writers, who themselves are involved in the film industry in one way or another. And so it's really good to have their insights. Kai Ross, who has a podcast, which we talk about, and Ian Killick, who also works as a film lecturer and as a film director and editor himself. So I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Well, yes. Hey, you guys, bless them, were the first ones to say yes and not stop and leave us alone. Cinema Retro, which is another lovely mag, Scream Magazine, and a few other things. I have a restaurant as well, which kind of takes up the bulk of the time, and it's slightly unforgiving in its writing schedule allowance anyway. But yeah.
What's the name of the restaurant so that we can channel funnel some writers on film patrons in that direction?
Writers on film listeners get a 1% discount.
Whoa!
Which is then added onto the bill afterwards. It's sort of Paysan in North Wales, Deganway, North Wales.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, wow. I used to, well, I didn't go that often to North Wales, but Cricieff was a place I would go to.
Yes.
On the coast.
You were just around the corner from Port Merryn.
Yeah, exactly, which I never went to, even though I'm a huge Prisoners fan. And, of course, you present a podcast on The Prisoner, right? Free for All.
Yes, Free for All, yeah, with my estimable chum Chris Bainbridge as well. And that's been immense fun.
How long have you been doing that for?
I think it was about December last year it started. So it's we've gone through all 17 episodes, occasionally 70 episodes. You've been chatting for an hour and you realize you've only just got past the opening credits. A few of them have stretched out, but it's coming to its end. We've already done Fallout, and that took 3 episodes to get through. Gads.
Right. I mean, God, there's so much in that episode as well. It's so I think it felt to me like the series got to a point where it's a little bit like Lost. There's a certain level of puzzledom that you basically painted yourself into a corner. There's no way out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it stopped. I think for the last 2 episodes, it essentially stopped being a spy drama of any description and just became a pure allegory, which is great. It's just limitless interpretations. But anyone waiting for the sort of bit where he pulls out the gun and gets tied to a table with a laser is just thinking, what the hell is going on?
People in gorilla suits and, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't get it. But at the same time, it's just, you can interpret it any way you can, which is, it's kind of one of the ways, I would say, has dated some of the sort of 60s-ness of it. But really, particularly watching it on the new Blu-ray, pin sharp transfer, and you think this could have come out, yeah, a few hairstyles notwithstanding. This has lasted spectacularly well.
Yeah. Have you read Alex Cox's book on the Prisoner? Because he has a sort of real unifying field theory of the whole thing, which is kind of fascinating, but.
Yeah,
but wrong.
Yeah, but maybe. Yeah, it was a great. I mean, it brings that sort of Coxian sort of worldview to all the episodes, and it's a great episode guide. But it sort of builds to this big sort of reveal, which is, I think he was a rocket scientist. Is that it? I really thought it'd be something else.
Yeah, it's the British nuclear war, nuclear weapon program, isn't it, that he thinks of as the thing that ties it all together, and it's like,
yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah, but then, you know, you kind of think, well, why not, you know, it could be. There's, McGoohan was spectacularly gnomic in his later years. He kind of very, even when he was doing interviews, he'd completely contradict himself. He left no breadcrumb trail, so, you know, if he thinks it's there's nothing to say it isn't, really. There's no sort of definite answer.
Yeah,
that
doesn't
stop people tearing each other's hair out on Twitter about it, though.
Have you had a lot of like blowback to the on the series? Not blowback, I mean reaction, I guess. Blowback sounds too negative.
Yeah, no, it's been incredibly satisfying. It's been lovely. The feedback's been really great, really warm. You've kind of found yourself in a nice, just a community of people who are just really, the feedback's been enormously kind. And you've made some sort of, you know, on Twitter, you can make sort of genuine pals in a way. And it's been lovely. There hasn't been any, excuse me, I think you'll find there's been none of that sort of gatekeeperish nonsense which can make these... You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I love the as well that you use the word community rather than fandom, because I think fandom has just become so poisonous, and community. We all like the same thing, but we don't have to necessarily have the same ideological slant to everything. You know?
No. But it's been really, really good actually. And some of the guys we've had on, people like Robert Fairclough, who's a really good. He's written probably the best sort of definitive kind of guide to the Prisoner. He's been very supportive and good fun, and some of the guys from the fan club, the Six of One, and Darren Nesbitt. Do you remember him from Where Eagles Dare?
Yes. Wow.
He's, because there's only, that's the thing, the problem with it. You go, well, who should we interview? There are three surviving members. And
wait a second. He was like the blonde Nazi with the thick lips.
In Where Eagles Dare.
Yes.
Takes one in the head after that spectacularly long sort of writing a name on the pad scene.
Yeah. My word.
But he was great. Yeah, he had a few Richard Burton anecdotes, which was sort of kind of what you'd expect. But he was great fun, incredibly foul mouthed. We had to sort of just, I've never had to bleep so much. And Jane Merrow. She was in the Lion of Winter. She was in a few sort of quite big films, but she was also. Do you remember the Schizoid Man?
Peter O'Toole and Anthony Hopkins, Lion in Winter.
O'Toole. Yes.
Yes. I don't like my children. which is actually from Beckett. There's a bit in Beckett where his wife says, "But think of your children," and he goes, "I don't like my children." It's like, okay, that's an alternative. You know, I know it's in a movie and everything, but I get a feeling that's just Peter O'Toole telling you about his family.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know where I summoned that up from.
Yeah.
Because he was playing the same king, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's just later on. It's kind of like it's one of those weird films where it's kind of historically a sequel, but not not. Generically not a sequel, you know.
Henry the Second and Three.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. And so you had her on as the to talk to as well.
Yeah, she was in an episode, The Schizoid Man, which is the one where they do the wonderful I think almost all 60s shows did this at some point. The leading actor plays against the leading actor using amazing split screen technology.
Yeah, which I usually remember involves... some Star Trek.
Which always involves them sort of facing each other in profile.
Yeah.
At some point. And then sort of two of them having to walk towards a door while the stuntman looks away from the camera. But she was delightful. Again, this is the thing. So you ask these people, and you think, oh, God, this must be the last thing they want to do. Please talk to some stranger about the prisoner again. But no, they all did it willingly, were delightful. And it's been an immensely gratifying experience, really.
That's amazing. That's really good. I'm really pleased that you're doing this as well, because there's Ian Killick coming into the waiting room. Let's admit him as well.
Indeed.
I love having Zoom where you have a waiting room where you can sort of like...
You should have a serve canapes option.
Yes.
While he's waiting in the waiting room.
Absolutely. Leafing through drinks. Magazines. Leafing through like old copies of sort of family magazines and Radio Times and such.
Well, looking.
Hi, Ian. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yeah, I can hear you fine. Hello, John.
Hi. Kai's with us as well. Kai's brought his own beer as well, which is making me feel a bit thirsty. I'm going to have to pop downstairs and grab a beer.
Oh, I didn't realise it was that sort of event.
No, that's as racy as it gets.
Excellent.
I have just finished work, though, so
it seems appropriate then.
Have you guys been listening to the podcast like from the beginning, or what's your...
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, because I was thinking about this before I joined you. I was thinking, how long has it been going? And in my mind, I would say it's been a year. Mm. So I'm guessing I was there fairly early, I would say. Yeah.
You're a writer as well, Ian. Is that right?
Very occasionally, yeah. Mm. I think like a lot of us, I do a number of things. So I probably lecture for about maybe 4 to 6 months of the year, give or take. But the rest of the time I earn sort of a lot of my other money from editing and occasionally, because it's an expensive business, but occasionally writing and directing. So so yeah, probably maybe one short a year I get to do, but the rest of the time I'm editing other people's material, and then I teach film editing in some of the universities in London.
Wow, because I'm just reading the Michael Ondaatje, Walter Murch book, The Conversations.
Which, it's very good. Yeah,
it's so good. I mean, I have to. I stole a story that he does for a tweet earlier on, where he's talking about George Lucas making Star Wars because he couldn't make Apocalypse Now, which I just think is wow. That's so interesting. That how Star Wars is being critiqued. Don't ruin my childhood, you know, with all this political shenanigans. What you mean the Vietnam allegory? You mean that innocent fable? No. With the Leni Riefenstahl ending, but you know, let's not talk about that. So when you're doing editing, are you editing like work for studios, or what sort of work are you doing?
No, I've actually only been doing it fairly recently. I've kind of done the career backwards. A lot of people sort of do the creative industries and then start lecturing as things wind down. I was lecturing first for the full time. And it was always teaching filmmaking, but then I stopped doing it full time when I was about 45, give or take 50. Mm. And then it was a case of thought, well, you kind of been teaching this for ages, but just get out and do it. And I've been very fortunate. It did. I think maybe living in London helps. So at the moment, I'm kind of still sort of actually in the ascent. I've only been doing it for sort of 4 or 5 years.
So
at the moment, I'm doing short films mostly and occasional sort of adverts. Couple of little bits for BBC ideas, but it's mostly sort of short films and marketing work that seems to be where a lot of the money is. So I'm still fairly new to it, and I've come close to doing a couple of features, but occasionally I think when one's quite new to it, you don't maybe always get stuff that kind of you want to cut. So at the moment I'm hovering around, should I really commit 2 months or 3 months to do that? So yeah, at the moment it's sort of very sort of low budget, sort of independently financed shorts, but the money's in marketing really. So yeah, but again, I've been fortunate. The work came in. I got one lucky job, and then that got passed around, and you know, sort of off you go. Yeah,
Jonathan Glazer. Was it Jonathan Glazer or who was it? Oh, no, the guy who did... was it Vincenzo Natale? It was somebody who was talking about directing films and it basically said, I have to take a pay cut.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I want to direct a feature film because
it
takes me out for a year and I would earn much more that year if I was just directing my adverts and my pop videos and whatnot, you know.
Mm. That was very true. I mean, there's a fascinating book I'd recommend called, well, fascinating stroke depressing called Dark Matters. Very good book written by, it's written during lockdown and it's interviews with directors that specifically who still live in London. So he's interviewing Joanna Hogg and, living in London. Maybe they're British based, but it's Joanna Hogg, Andrew Arnold and Peter Strickland. And pretty much they all say to a person, you know, yeah, unless you're Chris Nolan or you're Edgar Wright and Ridley Scott and you go to American money, you won't make money, you know, in London. And odd enough, Peter Strickland was of all of them, a lot of them were quite cagey actually about where they get their money from. You know, it's often you felt the family and friends element kicking in. But Strickland was fascinating. And I said, forgive me if I don't know the exact details, but he was saying probably over 10 years, he said he could add up, you know, what he's earned actually in terms of money from that. He said it's probably about £36,000.
Right.
Something like that. Forgive the exact figures. I don't want to be sued by Peter Strickland, but it's something very low. It was something that he went, oh, wow, I didn't. Oh, yeah. And so he does it for the love of it. And I think other times he writes and he teaches, I think, and other things kick in. But it was a fascinating reminder of, no, you know, you won't in Britain make money from doing it.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit what Pat McGilligan was talking about when he was talking about writing biographies, that he sort of said, you don't make money off any individual book, but if you build up a body of work, then at a certain point you reach a tipping point and you find, oh, you're actually getting enough royalties to be a professional writer. Mm. But if you think, I'm going to publish one book and that's it, you're on a hiding to nothing.
Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah.
And idiot that I am, I said, okay, I'll write a book for you. That, with that encouragement in mind, I'll do that.
Yeah, yeah. It's never stopped us. No, it doesn't stop us doing it, you know.
Do you get your kit from like from your teaching job, or do you just get?
I suppose as a self-employed person, you know, you have to get things like Avid Media Composer, which I probably prefer cutting on Premiere Pro. But obviously you use that as part of your, you know, you claim against that at the end of the year. So no, it'd be lovely if we got those kind of resources, but no, you kind of have to be a sort of a one-man band, but you claim it back, I guess, at the end of the year. But when it comes to sort of filmmaking, if I'm directing, yeah, you know, you're using rental houses in London just to hire all the stuff, I guess. Yeah. And it's, as you say, I think I've certainly lost money on every shoot I've made. You know, you do it. I think it's one of the things I lecture. So I'm going to steal a phrase now. I'm going to steal it from George Lucas. Mm. So I only direct sometimes. So I've got something I want to edit, and I only write so as I can have something to direct, which is something that he said to Paul Hirsch, I think. When they were cutting Star Wars. And I think there's something in that. So I do like lecturing, particularly because it is about film editing, so it is a privilege to be able to just talk about film editing. But a lot of it pays then for the privilege to make a short film. And then I grab whatever editing work I can to sort of supplement it. So, yes, it's definitely the tail wags the dog, yeah.
Mm-hmm. God, that's so interesting, especially when you think of people like Strickland and Joanna Hogg and you think, oh, you guys have arrived, you're here, you're going to be invited to every festival and all the rest of it. And then, you know, they basically have to have a day job. What was the name of the Kelly Reichardt? There was a story on Twitter that I read where it was saying, like, she has to have a teaching job. She has to have a day job.
She lectures, yeah. And I think she actually lectures kind of full time, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. You know, Mark Jenkin, you know, who does Ennis Men and Bates.
Yeah.
He teaches still at the University of Cornwall, I think, or maybe Devon.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, he's made it. You know, guy's been at Cannes for good. You know, but
I interviewed him this year. I interviewed him after Ennis Men, Ennis Men. Yes, it's pronounced men, isn't it? The word is for an island. It's Cornish for island, apparently. What about you, Kai? Have you ever sort of gone into on the other side of the camera, sort of?
Directing.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. I studied scriptwriting in university in the late 90s, and then made the brilliant decision to go back home to North Wales. And sort of, I was working for Channel 4 before. I should have just gone. This is regrets. I've had a few. Should have gone basically straight back down to London. But I stuck around and I sold a couple of scripts straight off the bat, which was wonderful. And then got it into my head somehow that, the internet's just arrived. I can do everything by email now and I can just stay up here. And then, you know how it is. I think if you sell a script, this will give you the option and you get paid for rewrites. But the bulk of it turns up when they film it.
First week of principal photography.
Yeah, which never came.
Right.
We had a sort of a read through with all the cast. I think Rob Brydon was there. He was going to play the lead. I was like, you better take September off and October because I think that's... And then it just didn't happen. Meanwhile, I was kind of... I think I have to get a credit card to cover some stuff here. And I ended up sort of taking over the restaurant from my parents. For the 6 months I thought it would take to get it back on. And that was 19 years ago, so...
Right, right. Yeah.
I wouldn't advise taking a restaurant if you want to do anything else. So it's a little bit... It hogs your time.
Yeah, I can. It's not exactly like you've got a lot of free time either side of that for, as you say, writing or pursuing other interests.
Yes, but I mean, I've got enough time to. I mean, working on a script now with somebody else's kind of input, that would be quite interesting. So you do have it's time management if you can block it off. But just kind of using contacts you've made over the years to maybe sort of nudge stuff further than just sending stuff blindly to a production company, which I think is kind of like trying to attract the attention of a passenger plane by flicking elastic bands at it from the ground.
What a brilliant image. What a beautiful image. I'm going to steal that. Consider that stolen.
I think I stole it from a friend of mine. So, yes, it's doing...
it's doing the rounds. At some point, it's going to arrive back at you and you'll know, like a boomerang cliche sort of thing. Not cliche, better than a cliche. What about what films have you been sort of seen recently that I'm sort of thinking not even recently, but just this year? Has there been anything that you've watched that has stood out particularly?
Yeah. Oh, goodness. I mean, I think it's been a really good year, as the last couple have been. And I think some standouts for me, The Innocence, which I enjoyed enormously. And The Quiet Girl, I thought was good. Compartment Number 6, I think, definitely.
Very good film, yeah.
I genuinely was, you know, it's the thing you want from a film. I came out moved and I felt the characters. I felt every beat of it. And I thought it's just a wonderful... the thing I enjoy more than anything is the sort of, you know, films, you know, what does it mean to be human? And it means being flawed, but forgiving. And I thought Compartment Number 6 was fantastic. Worst Person in the World, I think, would be high up there. And I think I'm particularly amazed, you know, that the chap who wrote or was the co-writer, I think, of Worst Person in the World, also wrote and directed The Innocents. And you think, that's a rare talent. So I'm probably going to put those two, because I think for the fact that one person can write both of those, and they're such incredibly different films. But for me, The Innocents, I think, is near the top, purely because it's such stripped-down cinema that the concept is so simple. But every scene is... I think particularly because I'm fascinated with editing, but every scene is just maximised in terms of suspense. It's one of the most slowest built films of dread I've seen. So, yeah, The Innocents would be very high up, I think, for me.
Yeah, it's a real slow burn without being being a slow movie as well.
That's the thing, yeah.
It's a real trick to pull.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. It's not slow, but it's just like, yeah, and that because some films are slow burns, but they're just slow. Yeah, no, that's a wonderful way of putting it. And so, yeah, that's probably very high up for me, that film. That's going to have another rewatch, I think, soon.
Yeah, I remember watching Compartment 6 and at the very beginning really hating it, thinking like in the first 10, 20 minutes, I was just thinking, God, this guy's so awful. And I know where this is going to go, but I don't know how the hell it's going to get there because this guy's such an idiot. And then it worked. It managed to do exactly that. And there was a bit where I realized, oh wait, it's not a love story. It's like lost brothers and a lost brother and sister coming together. You know, it's about friendship. And I really like films which are about friendship, which really value friendship rather than think, well, it's second best. You know, like. You know, friendship isn't a failed romance. It's a thing in and of itself, you know.
It's a very good thing you say, because I do remember, now you say it, I'd forgotten that, but I definitely found it a bit annoying, because I thought there's no way a woman, even back then, you know, because it's set 30-odd years ago or something, even then, no one would tolerate anyone that annoying. Why doesn't she just go away? But after something definitely clicked after 20 minutes, and that was it. That wonderful moment in the cinema where you lose sense of space and time and the walls around you. Yeah, you're in the screen. But yeah, 20 minutes, that's interesting. I was quite annoyed by her for just allowing him to carry on.
Yeah, exactly.
And I thought, this is ridiculous. Come on, say something. But then her power was the way she dealt with him. And it was fascinating film. Fascinating.
Yeah, it's Yuri Borisov. The guy who plays I think that's him. I think that's Yuri Borisov. Is the guy who plays the lead, because he was in a whole bunch of films that year. Because it's, I remember seeing it. I think I saw it last year, and it was he was in that, and he was in Petrov's Flu, and he was in. There's a Russian film about such and such a person, Colonel So and So has gone missing or something. It had that, and it just really made you think, wow, this guy, he can do everything. He's just amazing in everything. And it's not the worst side effect of the Ukraine-Russian invasion, but it does make you feel, wow, that guy's career is gonna go in a different direction now, or it's gonna be stalled, because internationally he was really making his name.
Very sad. Yeah.
What about you, Kai?
Well, to my great shame, mainly because of sort of the hours I keep, I don't really sort of get. I've not been able to see much really. I saw last Sunday. I saw Licorice Pizza for the first time.
Oh wow!
A bit late onto that, and I was very impressed by it eventually. Because I thought, is this kind of slight or is it me? And then I sort of, it started to just, I couldn't get it out of my head. It started, some of the films kind of go to work on you a little bit after you've seen them. And I started realizing just how effective it was and how delightful I thought the actors were. I hadn't even realized it was Philip Seymour Hoffman's son as well. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, there was James Gandolfini's son was in The Last Saints of Newark the same year.
Yes.
So it was like, almost, but is this a thing now that we've got? We're having sort of the sons of dead actors turn up everywhere.
Was that? I just heard nothing but kind of 3-star reviews for that. It seemed to be sort of
Many Saints. Yeah,
yes,
it was. It fully deserved those 3-star reviews. It wasn't. It wasn't good. It was. It was a. If it was an episode, if it was a bottle episode of The Sopranos, you would have been going, "What the? What's this?" You know, because it was hitting very similar beats of sort of misogyny and, you know, but without the, it wasn't convincing. It didn't, it felt very much like a retread. It didn't feel like anything particularly, you know, necessary. And I was really hyped for it. I thought it was going to be great, you know, but yeah, no, it just didn't do it for me. It felt, it felt very like a TV movie, which I guess is what it ended up being.
Yeah, I guess, I suppose. It's, I've also, I mean, it's a continuation of lockdown, really, sort of trying to fill in missing pieces in my sort of history. I've been on a bit of an Alan Delon binge, and I've, all these things that you think, oh, like The Samurai, first time I've seen it, crying out loud. I should have seen that when I was 16. And then you, that bumps, then suddenly you watch that and you think, you do a bit of research and you think, flick, I'll try a bit of that. Somebody put me onto The Cercle Rouge. Mm-hmm. The guy I did the podcast with about the Gallo, Dark Matters, I forget his name, but he put me onto The Cercle Rouge. So yeah, it's more a bit of that. So to my great shame, I've got a big lot stacked up. I really want to see The Souvenir Part 2. That's ready to go. But also, I'm sort of kind of cursed with the unavailability of, I've only got the one cinema, which usually only has the one Marvel film on 18 available screens.
Right.
And Downton Abbey.
There's always spoons in the restaurant which you can use to gouge your eyes out if you want an alternative. Licorice Pizza, I loved. I went to see that. I was in a film festival in Norway, and there was a late night, late-ish sort of 10:30. I mean, let's face it, in Norway in winter, 3:30 is late. But it was like a 10:30 screening, and I was tired. And I said to a guy I was with, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. And he went, no, you haven't seen it. You go and watch it, because I guarantee you, the minute it starts, you'll forget what time it is, and you'll just go through the whole film with a smile on your face. And I did. And there are scenes in that where I think, I've never seen this before. Like driving the truck without reversing the truck without petrol down the hills. I just think, how is that it's like an action set piece in a coming of age story. And it's just perfect. I'd love to get your opinion on this, Ian, in terms of the editing and everything, because that just feels masterful to me as a set piece, you know?
Well, Paul Thomas Anderson editing. A huge fan since, I think I saw his first film, Hard Eight, and then Boogie Nights and Magnolia. Boogie Nights I saw first, then Hard Eight and Magnolia. But I don't know if he has his longtime collaborator still in there, but Dylan Tishnell usually edits all of his stuff. And the editing is absolutely incredible. It's the thing you want more than anything, which is every cut is motivated by the emotion. You know, and that sounds odd, but whether the emotion is the movement of a truck, that's still an emotional moment. It's a thing. And Dylan Tishnell's editing. I'm very reluctant to start Googling stuff now whilst we're doing this. So I don't know if Dylan Tishnell still does.
I'll do it for you.
I'll let you do it. But I've long been a fan of the editing of Paul Thomas, and again, particularly Dylan Tishnell's stuff. I think the editing in There'll Be Blood and Phantom Thread is some of the best I've ever seen. I think he's an absolute masterclass in cutting, particularly in There'll Be Blood. He takes something where clearly Daniel Day-Lewis has all of the dialogue, but he actually spends most of his time cutting away to Vicky Krieps and cutting away to, I forget the other woman's name.
That's terrible.
Thank you, one of our greatest actors. So he spends most of the time cutting to their reaction. So you're kind of getting their reactions, but you're hearing Day-Lewis at the same time. So they actually become the women's scenes instead of Day-Lewis's. And so so I think he's very good at point. I suppose in summary, I think Thomas Anderson is just very good at point of view. He's very good at placing exactly whose moment this is and who we should be feeling as an audience. I've long been a fan.
Yeah. It's Andy Jurgensen.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. I'm always fascinated because, again, particularly because editing is just the thing I grew up with. I used to read all those photo play books in the 70s of Alien and Psycho. And I just read all the little pic. And so I learned grammar of film quite young. And I'm always fascinated, particularly when an editor has been with somebody for such a long time, but then suddenly they're not. You know, like Chris Nolan has had an editor all the way through, I think every one of his films, and then he used Jennifer Lane for Tenet. Now, Jennifer Lane did, you know, Marriage Story and Frances Ha and Hereditary. What was possibly, I mean, I love her work. I think she's a genius. But what I always say, what was it that suddenly happened where Chris Nolan went, right, I'm making this incredibly big esoteric, didn't work for me, I have to say, film. I'll use Jennifer Lane. She's the... I find it odd. I find it fascinating where the person I've used for so long, did they have a row? Or it's, again, for me, I don't think I'll ever write a book, but if I did, it would be on partnerships between editors and directors.
Write that book. That sounds like a fascinating idea.
But I'm fascinated what happened to Dylan Tishnar, who just worked with him so long, and then obviously I think his career is doing really well, but don't know what happened there. But what's interesting about that is the editing is still a very good in inherent vice. It's a reminder that as an editor, we have to sort of remind that it is a collaboration. It's the director's film as well. You know, that could be as responsible for those cuts as the editor is. You know? So you have to sort of bear that in mind. It's hard to know where the input for the editor begins and the director stops, you know. But yeah, one day I'll write that book. I will do.
I think Sally Menke was a huge loss. I mean, it was a huge loss to her family and her career and everything. But Quentin Tarantino's films, there's a definite, you know, before Menke dies and then after.
Yeah.
And it feels like Tarantino no longer has a really strong voice. Again, that sort of battles with him. That's you know, his indulgence just sweeps over the films that she hasn't cut.
Yeah, I think some truth in that. I think Raskin's a very muscular director. He's very good at impact, but I think Sally Menke was better at rhythm. You know, she could, even if I've sometimes had problems with the overall narrative of Tarantino's, I think Sally Menke, you know, if you look at the bar seller scene in Inglourious Basterds, it is a masterclass of rhythm and pacing, you know, absolutely faultless. And although I still enjoy Raskin's work, I've not seen that quality quite to the same level since he's picked up the reins. As good as it is, you know, it still is. But
Can I ask you, Ian, just as a curiosity, how much when a film is actually being edited, how much is there actually a director and editor basically sitting in the same room situation?
It depends on the director, really. I've had occasions, and again, I've only done sort of shorts at the moment, but on the occasions I do them, it's 50-50, you know? So I've had them sitting right next to me and calling the shots, as it were. I've had them sometimes leave me alone for 4 or 5 days, then they'll watch the cut, and then they give you a load of notes, and then they'll say, right, can you do these notes for me? And then you'll come back. So it really depends on the nature of the director. They all seem to be very different. Certainly, you know, rumor has it Oliver Stone just never sets foot in the edit suite. Just, no, trust you, off you go. And barely ever sets his head in the door. Whereas some of them will be there pretty much all the time. So it's 50-50, really. I like a bit of both, you know. I think because as editors, you'd like to sort of sometimes they can, and I'm guilty of it, you can kind of fall prey to a bit of arrogance. I know the answers to all of these things. Leave it to me.
I'll save this.
I can save this. But actually, when I was doing it today, I had an online, you know, I'm editing an advert at the moment, and we had an hour with the director, and his ideas were great, you know, and it's actually nice to hear that, because you sometimes can be quite an isolated part of the process. So I think when they're really great directors, I love being with them and kicking it back and forward, you know, it's a very nice thing to do. But when it's worse is they kind of just sit next to you and actually get you to press every edit they want. Oh. And so you're kind of a technician, really. But still, hey, it's good work, you know. It's never turn it down.
There's a book I read called Dream Repairman, Adventures in Film Editing by Jim Clark, who's an editor who's done a whole bunch of famous films, James Bond films, and I think Midnight Cowboy was one of the first films he worked on. And the whole premise of the book, it's an entertaining book and everything, but the whole premise of the book is him receiving the film, from the title, Dream Repair Man, him receiving the film and going, what's this shit? What a load of rubbish. Oh, okay, here I go, and fixing it. And so it's like, you know, I think he edited The Sorcerer, the William Friedkin film.
Oh, wow.
And him saying, you know, it was rubbish. It was absolutely, you know, you couldn't make head and the tail of it. And I managed to put something together which could be screened. And one of the James Bond films, I remember, he's just so snarky, this guy. He said, oh, yeah, and the theme music was by a band called Garbage, which was absolutely, literally true. It's not like... Come on, man. Come on, man. Steady on. Yeah, steady on.
We're there to support the process, you know, as best as we can. It's
Yeah. He seemed to sort of like very much think. I mean, and I've just read the Glenn Frankel book about Midnight Cowboy. And yeah, there was definitely some saving of that film in the editing. But there was a great film there to be found. It wasn't a pile of rubbish. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I've heard that occasionally, and you have to sort of temper your thoughts, really, because again, I've not been doing it for very long, and I'm still fairly new to it, but the 6 or 8 shorts I've cut, you know, the director's in a very sensitive place, you know, they've spent their money, and they have, you know, they've put their love into it, and to sit there and say, oh, this is a, no, you... I think, as David Geffen said, you know, you could think it, but don't say it. You know?
Yeah. Least said, soonest mended.
That's it. Yeah, you want to be hired again. That's always my view. So,
yeah, every job is a step to the next job.
The next one. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Kai, what about a recommended film book from you? What film book have you read that you?
I think I have listened to every single one of the podcasts and.
Yes,
I'm amazed. No one has actually said Adventures in the Screen Trade.
Good call.
I kind of thought, well, at some point, somebody's surely going to say this. But I mean, it's kind of strange because it's written about 82, so all these references to, well, this summer Rocky 3 will be coming out, and here's my views on that. And it's kind of early 80s thing. But everything he says in there is nothing's changed at all. And I quite like it from a sort of like writer's point of view, that at the end of the sort of the last third, and I think he does the same thing with What Lie Did I Tell? He kind of wrote a sort of sequel to this, where there's almost like an exercise in how to write scripts, and here's the feedback I got. And but it's quite an interesting book about how to write, not so much in terms of getting the act structure right and how to manipulate dialogue or anything like that, but more like how to please. Here's what the star is going to say when he reads this. He will say, I'm not here to discover this, I already know, rewrite please. And all that. And of course the anecdotes are hilarious. It's kind of, it's from the same sort of you'll never eat lunch in this town again sort of vibe. But I mean, that was one of the first ones that I thought, and it's one of the first ones that really got me into books about films. And previously it had been sort of novelizations with 24 color illustrations in the middle, and then sort of the paperbacks about how films were, and then getting to maybe sort of Barry Norman books, and it started to build and build. But for some reason, I think the Adventures in the Screen Trade was the first one. It was like a step up suddenly, and then sort of. You're into different territory then, and then suddenly the long march to Peter Biskind and that sort of thing. But that only because nobody else has picked it, I'm going to throw that one onto the splendid pile.
Yeah, he's superb. I love William Goldwyn. Yeah, it's a really surprising omission, that, actually. Yeah, and maybe it's in the sequel that he actually writes a screenplay for a director, and has the director criticize it, say no, this is you know, he'd write something like exterior, a heartbreakingly beautiful day, and the director's going, how the fuck am I supposed to do that, you know, how do I film that?
I think it was George Roy Hill was the director.
That's right, yes that's true.
And there was a magic haircut, it was like a short story about a magic haircut, And his best friend says, "I really like your hair, man." And George Roy Hill says, "No kid would ever say that to his mate." So there's stuff like that. But yeah, because obviously he wrote the Butch Cassidy script, so he had form with him. But yeah, no, it's wonderful. Yeah, the feedback is just fascinating to read, and it's quite nice that somebody like Goldman would actually allow the readers to read the negative feedback of his script. This $1 million a rewrite scriptwriter still gets feedback saying, "What the hell's this?"
Yeah. How am I supposed to do this practically? How can I?
Yeah, you know, Jesus, William, you should know by now.
It's interesting because Goldman always strikes me as well as kind of the opposite. I don't know why I sort of think of the celebrity sort of death fights, but I always think of William Goldman and Robert Town being in opposite corners for some reason, even though they're probably very similar as, you know, in terms of career. But William Goldman is very much revealing, this is how I do it. Nobody knows anything. We're all a bunch of schmucks. And Robert Town feels more like, I'm not going to tell you that I actually wrote this with another guy in the room collaborating with me all the time.
I think, yeah, Goldman was very good at sort of just saying, I can't believe I did. His favorite anecdotes seem to be the ones where he screwed up royally. I think maybe he's enough of a writer to understand. He probably thinks the reader will think, this is actually the most interesting. This is one I'll skip to.
Yeah,
but at the same time, it takes a sort of bit of selflessness to be able to say, here's the time I tried to write this, and oh my God, what a nightmare.
I mean, one thing I've noticed doing the podcast is bad movies make great books, in the sense that, you know, it's the Bonfire of Vanities which makes the best film book, you know, not, I mean, the Mad Max Fury Road is kind of like really, really trying to prove that wrong by saying, look, let's see how a great film is made. But even there, you're kind of very aware of how close that came to going absolutely wrong. What about you, Ian? Have you got a film book recommendation?
Well, I mean, again, I think all of the ones that have been, you know, covered in the podcast would be high up the list. So I sort of, like Kai, I don't want to sort of go over ground that's been covered. So there's probably, I think one, and it's just a bit of a tricky one because you have to get it on import. You can't get it. It has never been released in this country, but this one is just purely for the fun of the absolute chaos, but actually something kind of fun came over it. So I'm going to go fairly lowbrow, and I'm going for a book called The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, which is about the making of Caddyshack. And it came out a year ago. And it is fascinating. Why it's not had a release here, I don't know. I had to get it imported. It's I've got it here. There we go. And it is a delight. So I'm going for a lowbrow film, but it contains all the stuff that you'd want from a really good making book, you know, the writing of it, which was a complete chaos. You know, there wasn't, as you'd imagine, there wasn't a script, and the absolute chaos of filming it with staggeringly difficult personalities. You know, I mean, you do wonder at the sanity of poor old Harold Ramis, who had to sort of work with these people, and then chose to do it again many times with two particularly very difficult men. But I found it fascinating again because I think for the same reason that, you know, Kai said with Adventure in Screen Trade, it's the best ones really look under the hood. You know, and you get under the hood of all the decision-making processes. And again, this is an interesting one, but, you know, it was chaotic, you know, a little bit like, say, you know, Bonfire of Vanities maybe, but you got the sense that they still kind of knew what they were making. So like Mad Max Fury Road, you get the sense that it sails close to the wind, but they still kind of knew what they were doing. But what's fascinating in particular is that when they had it finished, they actually, I think this is the sort of the particularly fun part of the book, is they actually basically did rewrite the film in the edit. This was one of those ones like, what was the William Friedkin musical that was a huge flop, but then the editor did come in and re-put it together again. I can't remember. It was before French Connection. Nightmare of Ada Minsky's.
Oh yeah,
And Friedkin claims, oh yes, that was all my idea. But I think on this occasion the editor did say that. So it was interesting that, and that film was literally rewritten in the edit, and Caddyshack was as well. So they had a cut that was something like 4 hours, And they pretty much cut all of the stuff out with the teenagers and said, well, the story really is, you know, the older guys battling against each other to sort of claim. So that, and I thought that was fascinating that you think you've got one thing, but they literally did cut pretty much 2.5 hours out and said, we'll just get rid of all the stuff with the teenagers. That's just not interesting.
Adrian Brody lands on the cutting room floor.
The thin red
again.
Line pile. Yeah. So it's a lowbrow book, but it's, again, you know, I put it up there with, it has the depth and breadth of, you know, the Chinatown book and the, you know, the Highlander book. It's in that book and you know, the Mad Max one, which is a fascinating approach. But yeah, highly recommend it. It's obviously, I think you need to be, have maybe fond memories of the film as a kid to sort of get it. So it's possibly a little niche. But it's a wonderful read. It's up there, I think, with the best of them.
What's the name of the writer?
So the writer is Chris Nashawati. Let me just hold that up. Not sure I can quite get that.
Okay, Chris Nashawati. Yeah. Nashawati, I think, is the pronunciation. I'll put it in the show notes so that people can try to get it on import. It might just be simply he hasn't
get
got
it on Amazon. Right. Yeah, I just got it through Amazon, and it's just, yeah, it's an odd one. Just hasn't had a release in this country, but
But there is a thing about British libel laws, which there are some books that have never come out about Hollywood specifically that haven't come out in England because they think they would get. They would get sued, you know, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah. Because in America, you've got freedom of speech as a sort of constitutional right.
Of course, yeah. That would make sense, because, yes, now you said that, that does make a lot of sense.
I mean, I'm not sure if that's the case. They might just not have a British publisher. That might, you know, it might just be an economic decision. But
it's a more of a niche film, I suspect. It may not have got much traction here.
It's one of those, you know, it's the cult favorite, which often means it lost loads of money for everybody and then got bought cheap for TVs. Thank you guys for let's maybe do this again sometime when great to have a conversation like this.
Pleasure. And seriously, congratulations on it for your anniversary of it. I can't, every week it's a proper highlight, you know.
Oh, good.
And nobody else is doing it, and you've got it. I think you've come up with something just absolutely spot on. It's lovely to hear the guests you have, particularly like the American guests who kind of might not know you and everything. The way you can hear them just warming to you, because they can tell A, you know what you're talking about. B, you're passionate, and it's not a clickbait thing. You're not trapping anyone, and they just kind of, it's lovely. It's just, every one of them is a pearl.
It is. I have to second that. It's a wonderful podcast. And I think particularly important, you know, in an age where we don't have bookstores, you are serving that function of curating good books for people to look at. You know, the interviews are fantastic. You know, you do the one thing, which is you give them time to talk and to breathe into what they're saying. But and on a functional level, you know, we don't have bookstores now, you know, so you need a curated place to find good books, and it's wonderful. What's my next book, you know. I know I've got one coming soon, so it's lovely to have almost a good editor saying, well, this is how this is, you know. It's like you're curating a really good store of books for people to find. So no, thank you, it's a wonderful podcast.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, I really appreciate that, guys. It really means a lot. So that was a special episode of Writers on Film with far too many recommended books for me to detail here. I was really great talking to a diverse bunch of people, from film critics like Luke Hicks and Jason Solomons, all the way through to Ian Killick and Kai Ross and everybody else in between. I'm sorry, I'm not naming everybody, but I'll put them all in the names in the show notes so that you know who you were listening to. I really enjoyed that conversation. I really enjoyed the variety, and I hope you did too. Thank you very much to Elliot Atkins for the music, to Ali Harwood for the art. Thank you to everybody who took part. Absolutely, absolutely great. And thank you also to the listener. I'll talk to you next week.